So thank you, Andre, and thank you to the other organizers for inviting me to this beautiful place. It's always very daunting to give an overview talk, particularly when the subsequent speakers are the people who've done essentially all of the work. However, I did at least console myself that I didn't have Brad's task. So talking now about ferromagnetic quantum criticality, the way I decided to do this is really to provide the introduction to some of the talks that you're going to see coming up in this session, and then to focus on things that are not going to be covered to quite the same extent. So I'm going to begin with a little bit of a historical introduction to discuss paramagnons and the Hertz and Millis and subsequent work on the RG approach to understanding ferromagnetic quantum criticality. As we'll see, I'm sure, later on today, the notion of what the true action looks like at a ferromagnetic quantum critical point is one of the central things up for debate, or perhaps has already been answered now. And so I'm going to mention this but not go into the details, as I'm sure we're going to hear much more about it. Rather, I'm going to focus on the issue of tracking the original Hertz-Millis critical quantum critical point through the phase diagram by the introduction of magnetic field, which will lead us to the notion of metamagnetic quantum criticality, where the original RG picture that was proposed in 76 seems to be applicable. However, we'll see in reality that when looking at a particular example of this, coupling to other degrees of freedom still seem to be playing an important role. And then, in a sense, I'm going to switch gear, but there is a connection in that one of the typical things that quantum critical points have been studied for is the way that they can also catalyze other correlated states of matter, principally superconductivity. And of course, there is a whole wealth of work that's been done on the relationship between the ferromagnetic quantum critical point and the possibility of superconducting transitions being driven by that pairing mechanism. And then possibly there's the speculation that there may be other types of correlated states that are catalyzed perhaps close to a metamagnetic quantum critical endpoint. So that's where we're going. I want to begin, though, with paramagnon theory, which started about the same time as I did. And this then really was motivated by a whole load of materials that seem to be very close to ferromagnetism or weakly ferromagnetic. And these were itinerant materials, so things like palladium, which did not go ferromagnetic, but was a very enhanced paramagnet, to zirconium zinc too. And what characterized that was that although it magnetically ordered, the ordered moment was very small compared with the moment that one seemed to see at higher temperatures by the fluctuations. And essentially, the theoretical puzzle was that these materials seemed neither to satisfy an itinerant picture of mean field theory that sort of Stoner would suggest, or neither did they seem to look like local moment systems, but they shared characteristics of both. So, of course, an itinerant system can show a ferromagnetic instability at mean field level via a Stoner-type interaction when the interactions are sufficient to beat the kinetic energy cost of polarizing the system. And so it was known that interactions could essentially drive something ferromagnetic. And by the way, so typically people think about the equation of state of the system and the magnetic field and its relationship to the magnetization that one sees. And this first coefficient is the inverse susceptibility. And that could be tuned to be zero via Stoner theory, but of course the price that you pay is it's an electronic system, and the characteristic temperature scales that one gets from that are Fermi liquid-like, T squared, with some characteristic large energy scale determining how much T squared variation you're likely to see. And of course, in order to get something that looks Curie-Weiss-like at high temperatures, which is what was being seen, it was very challenging to get that out of a mean field Stoner-like description. Of course, going the other way, we know how to get Curie-Weiss from a Heisenberg-like picture, but then the problem was that the fluctuating moment that one saw at high temperatures was an order of magnitude or more larger than the ordered moment that eventually developed in some of these materials. Now, of course, the resolution to that was provided by many people over a number of years. And essentially, the idea was to go beyond a mean field theory description and to include the fluctuation effects on this magnetic equation of state. And one way to picture that is, for example, to allow fluctuations in the magnetization to renormalize the susceptibility. And at high temperatures, this fluctuation is likely to go linear in temperature. And so you would get quite a good agreement with experiment with an initial T squared like temperature dependence in the susceptibility above the, for low temperatures quite close to the magnetic transition, then crossing over to a Curie-Weiss type behavior, chi inverse going linear in T.
So all these spin fluctuations were classical in those days?
That's correct. So nothing, yes, so thank you very much, an important point. Yes, so this is being talked about in the context of classical finite temperature transitions. But of course the idea of using the interaction term to renormalize Gaussian terms in the theory is very familiar to us from RG approaches, and so perhaps it was natural then to view this whole notion of the paramagnon theory in the context of a renormalization group approach to put in self-consistency, which of course had been done by hand by people like Maria. So this, if you like, provided perhaps a more rigorous way of doing paramagnon theory, if you like. And of course now there was the possibility of including the quantum fluctuations in as well. And as we all know, in Hertz's original paper, the canonical system that he essentially looked at to a large degree in that paper was an itinerant ferromagnetic transition. And the idea, as we're going to debate no doubt tomorrow, is that essentially you do a sort of Hubbard-Stratonovich-like transformation to identify the slow fluctuating magnetic modes, integrate out the higher energy electrons to get an effective action for these slow modes. And essentially that action is an expansion in Q and omega. And the ingredients of that expansion come directly from a sort of RPA approach to the susceptibility. And since the very first thing that theory graduate students are typically asked to do is to compute the Linhart function, this is a rather familiar type expansion that people may recognize, where we have a gradient term, as you would expect for a classical phase transition, and here the quantum mechanics is entering via a Landau damping process, and of course for an itinerant ferromagnetic system, ferromagnetism is conserved, and so the zero wavelength, the infinite wavelength mode cannot decay, and this reflects itself in a damping rate that vanishes as Q goes to zero, and in a ballistic system, Landau damping would provide that. And so you would go linearly in Q to zero in Q. And of course, we've still got the higher order interaction terms, but now one can see how those interaction terms renormalize the theory in a systematic way via the renormalization group approach, which, as you all know, you integrate out the high energy modes, and you use the interaction terms to renormalize the effect of those missing modes as a renormalization of the bare parameters in the Gaussian theory. And you see the bare parameters in the original theory, and you see how this integrating out of these high degree of freedom affects the interaction terms in your model. And of course, what is found for this quantum version is that the interaction terms U and V that you wouldn't in general know how to handle become smaller and smaller as one goes to lower and lower energy scales and performs the RG. And that allows you then to compute things. Now, of course, I should say that many people would view a theory where the interactions essentially vanish as you approach the critical point as being a rather boring theory, because it means Gaussian physics is at work, and mean field theory works, and various scaling laws are not going to hold for a theory essentially above its upper critical dimension. When I first saw this, my background having been in HiTC, it looked a miracle to me that one could actually essentially solve something and make predictions of temperature dependencies that one would really hope to see in experiment. And to emphasize that, then people then evaluated the temperature dependencies that one should see. And what I've written down is a sort of summary of what is expected for a clean ferromagnetic quantum critical point within the original Hertz picture. But I should stress that, of course, at any finite temperature, these interaction terms have not yet been renormalized down to zero. And particularly in two dimensions, the interaction term can exert a strong influence on it as it renormalizes this mass term. People call that a dangerous, irrelevant operator. And so, for example, if you take the resistivity and actually calculate it numerically, the power law of 4/3 would only really be obtained at vanishingly small temperatures. And you see rather strong corrections to many of these power laws if you actually numerically integrate the RG. Okay, and so that was the basic theory, and initial results look very promising in comparison to that theory. So this is palladium, now doped lightly with nickel in order to drive it ferromagnetic, and at a small doping concentration of about 0.026, you're able to tune this material to a quantum critical point. So here is the ferromagnetic to paramagnetic transition. And now you can start to read off some of the exponents that were seen that I had in that previous table. This is a three-dimensional material. And so this resistivity of 5/3 was more or less seen. Similarly, specific heat and the tuning, the way the tuning parameter controls TC, all of these exponents seem to work. But the harder people worked on systems and provided cleaner and cleaner materials to test this idea, puzzling behavior was seen in that almost invariably it seemed that the transition would go first order, just as you tuned to where you thought the critical point should be. Now, as an aside, I mentioned MNSI, and of course we'll be hearing much more about this later, but historically, this was one of the compounds that was looked at to study ferromagnetic quantum criticality. Its complication is that it's not truly ferromagnetic at ambient pressure. It forms a long wavelength helical magnetic structure, but the wavelength was thought to be so long that really was probably very close enough to ferromagnetism for it not to matter. Interesting results that we're going to hear about later show that it looks very much as if this helical magnetic structure is playing a rather special role here. So I include this view graph really just to cover myself for not talking about MNSI. We're going to hear about it later. But I would argue that the physics that is being seen above this critical pressure looks rather likely to be due to this helical structure and not particularly quantum criticality of a ferromagnet. The one example that seemed to stand out as an exception to this rule that everything went first order was zirconium zinc 2, but very recently even that has now been shown to go first order at some very low temperature. So this is pressure being used to tune the ferromagnetism down to zero temperature, and we see that beyond a certain pressure, the transition temperature, the magnetic transition temperature, drops below base temperature. However, if one applies a magnetic field, one can still follow where this transition has gone, essentially by looking at a change in the magnetization, so-called metamagnetism. And that then suggests that we can still follow this critical point by exploring not just the pressure plane, but the magnetic field plane as well. So let me then give a very simple view as to how one would describe this transition to first orderness and then following the line of criticality into the magnetic field plane. And there's a very simple way of seeing that. If one wrote down a free energy, but now, in contrast to a usual Landau theory of second-order phase transitions, when one has an m-squared term, which is going to change sign at the coefficient of the m-squared term is going to change sign at the critical point, controlled by a positive m-fourth term. If this term is negative, meaning, if you like, attractive interactions between magnetic excitations, then that can drive the transition first order and show the sort of phase diagrams that are now being explored in the context of ferromagnetic systems on the border of magnetism. Now, I'll come back in a minute to why this thing should ever go negative, but let's just look at the general physics of this rather simple equation. It turns out that the phase diagram is determined entirely by this combination of these three coefficients. Of course, I now need a sixth order term in order to stabilize the theory, and I couple the magnetization linearly to the field. If this attractive interaction is weak enough, then it really plays very little role, and one still has a conventional second-order phase transition. However, and so that's this point up here, and as a function of magnetic field, essentially all one would see as one increases the magnetic field is the possibility of a crossover. However, what this term is trying to do, of course, is to pull down a second minimum in your free energy expansion, and eventually the free energy will develop an inflection point in the absence of a field, and that at that inflection point, then one gets a critical end point, and the transition and the magnetization below that then develops a kink, which is what is traditionally called metamagnetism. If this term is large enough, then effectively the transition itself will go first order even in the absence of an applied magnetic field. And so this is a very kind of characteristic picture of what a negative M4th term would do to the phase diagram. And notice that that does have a point where this is, of course, the end point of the line of first-order phase transitions, where there is still an infinite susceptibility, namely the critical endpoint of this line of first-order transitions. So this then paints a picture of what a generic phase diagram would look like, provided one could get this negative M4th term. One starts off, things have been dropped off the bottom, so this axis is tuning parameter. Pressure, for example, and as a function of temperature, one would generically, say, have a second order phase transition, but at low enough temperatures, if U goes negative, then this becomes first order. And if one wanted to follow the original critical point, one then has to move into the magnetic field plane. Thank you. One then has to move into the magnetic field plane, eventually, too, that line of first-order phase transitions, which is this blob here, could be suppressed down to zero. And finally, here, you get what's called the metamagnetic quantum critical endpoint, where you've basically finally tracked your Hertz-Millis theory right down to zero temperature. So now let me come to the issue of why one might ever get this negative M4th term appearing. And really the kind of class of explanation comes in two varieties. The first you might call special pleading, and the second it looks much more generic. So in terms of special pleading, materials like uranium, germanium-2 are known to have structures in the density of states via LDA type calculations. And if you get a negative curvature in the density of states, it's well known that you can get, in an expansion of the free energy, you will get a negative M4th term. And that traditionally is how people have thought of metamagnetism. That curvature in the density of states could come from proximity to a Van Hove point, and it's been argued in the ruthenates that that describes the phase diagram that you see. Of course, the weakness is you need to have some argument for every material that goes first order, and also you need to really explain why the energy scales are so low, the point at which this thing eventually goes first order. And so that is where the more recent work comes in, of looking at exactly the validity of the Hertz-Millis action that people had assumed since 76 and before. And here, a tremendous amount of work has been done by Dietrich Berlitz and Ted Kirkpatrick, Thomas Voiter, and other collaborators. There are a lot of references, and I'm afraid I've just picked a recent one, which you can then follow backwards through the literature. And what they show is that you need to be extremely careful in integrating out the electrons, in particular treating particle hole excitations at low energy in the spin triplet channel. And what they show is that a very careful treatment of that will lead to an additional term in your free energy action, M4, with a logarithmic dependence on M. And for M going small enough, clearly this is going to change the sign of the M4th term, and eventually will drive the original interaction term negative. And so their argument is that in a clean quantum critical point, eventually it will always not be quite quantum critical, it will go first order. Now you can ask what the role of disorder might be in washing that out. I think that's a challenging issue, but we may hear a bit more about that later. Now, there's related work which also shows that in terms of the gradient expansion, that there are problems in the sense that they're terms that appear to come in non-analytic in Q, representing, I guess, longer range interactions between magnetic excitations. And In addition to Bilics and company, recently Andrei Chubakov and co-workers have looked at this. And they, what they find is that these non-analytic terms not only are there, but they evolve as you get very close to the quantum critical point. And if the transition doesn't go first order, then something else is going to strange is going to happen, because the gradient, the Q term is also going negative, which suggests that the magnetic excitations, if they don't go first order, want to fold up on themselves and try and order at some finite Q. The precise relationship between what's going on here, I haven't quite got to the bottom of, right, what is the connection between this Q dependence and the free energy, but I suspect that will be answered this afternoon. But the one thing that kind of puzzled me is that, well, we thought we'd integrate out the fermions in the first place, and that the particle hole excitations, the magnetic particle hole excitations, well, weren't they supposed to be the magnetization that I was looking at in the first place to derive the effective action for? So there was, to me at least, an issue of how did I know whether I was overcounting or not? The answer to that, I think, comes by saying that given that our effective action in Hertz-Miller's theory came from the Lindhardt function, which is something I can ask about in the absence of being close to a quantum critical point, I could ask to see whether these sort of effects appear well away from a quantum critical point in terms of strange behavior of the susceptibility. Both its temperature dependence and its Q dependence. And that has been studied not just by these authors, but by other work. And again, I suspect we're going to hear a little bit about that later on today. But the bottom line seems to be that, in fact, there are indeed corrections to what people had assumed was valid Fermi-liquid theory that people seem to have missed before. And it looks like those corrections come, at least in part, from the enhanced probability of backscattering, particularly in two dimensions. So it does indeed look like there has been a long-standing problem with the way in which we've integrated out the fermions in the past, which can lead to effects that seem to be very reminiscent of what we're seeing experimentally in terms of first-order transitions being driven first order. Okay, so now having established this as the generic phase diagram for the ferromagnetic system, then one might ask, well, where can we see this phase diagram in practice? And many materials, of course, show aspects of this phase diagram, but I don't believe that there's a single one that has shown all of the aspects and been tracked through from second order at some low value of a tuning parameter right through to entirely paramagnetic with only crossovers in, as a function of field. However, there is a class of systems which you could argue could be put on this phase diagram and used to explore it. And that is a series of ruthenate compounds. So these are layered oxide materials, rather similar in structure to high-TC cuprates, lanthanum cuprates. However, these are 4D electrons. They're less strong, it's a bigger orbital, they're less strongly correlated, and I'll give you some evidence that an itinerant pitcher should work for that. And now what we're using as a tuning parameter is essentially the number of layers in the structure. And as you increase the number of layers in the structure, it provides a discrete tuning parameter, if you like, through this phase diagram. So the single layer compound, the single layer ruthenate, is the one that some of you may know as the potentially triplet superconductor. It's entirely paramagnetic, shows no ferromagnetism, so one would put it here. At the other end of the spectrum, the infinite layer compound, which is cubic, has a Curie temperature of around 160. Recently, the tri-layer compound has been made. It's got a Curie temperature of about 100 Kelvin. And this compound here, the bilayer compound, essentially appears to lie very close to where one would expect it to spontaneously go ferromagnetic. And it seems that there is an additional fine-tuning parameter that you can do. Namely, you can change the angle of the magnetic field. And that then allows you to explore this part of the phase diagram, and in particular, look at this the metamagnetic quantum critical endpoint.
Question. Yep. This tuning parameter, which is the membership number in a homologous series, on the same axis that you had been using for pressure, is this just poetic? Or do you actually mean to imply that pressure and the number in the homologous series can actually be correlated?
Okay.
I would urge some explanation or caveat before you lay a light on the pressure.
Okay, so I didn't really have this as a pressure, it's just tuning parameter. So
you're discussing other things that have been implicit.
Right, but okay, so what you would then like to do is to use pressure and see if you can move this, move members of this phase diagram around in the way that you would want to. Now, that has been looked at least particularly in the context of the single layer ruthenate, and pressure goes the wrong way. So you apply pressure and it makes, so it was hoped that this that might drive this closer to ferromagnetism. It looks like it applying pressure drives it, sorry, no, it goes the right way. So it drives it further away from being ferromagnetic. If I've got that the right way around, Christoph.
There's other ways, these are just four different materials that happen to lie in different parts
The best I can tell you is what you'd want to do is use pressure to see if you can move things around and have pressure as the same axis. So there have been studies, pressure has moved things around a little bit, and it does, I believe, go the way that you might expect from this picture. It depends whether the pressure is uniaxial or hydrostatic, and you can push it either way, but then of course we know that things are somewhat anisotropic anyway because of the field angle. I don't want to make much more of it than that. I want to show you that there's a class of systems that have all of these features. People have argued that from the band, that the band structure is rather similar, and you can explain all of these features from band structure effects. That's really as far as I want to go.
Not dimensionality.
Well, okay, so dimensionality is a bit more subtle with this thing, because you might have thought that as you make it more three-dimensional, you broaden the bands, you would drive it away from magnetism.
Of the best ferromagnets.
Yeah, so there are interactions, there are Hund's rule effects and interactions that are playing a role here that you would need to take into consideration. Right, okay, so the question then is, you know, what happens experimentally at this metamagnetic quantum critical point? The idea is that you're basically following the original Hertz theory down to zero temperature, and you're using angle to actually tune it down to zero temperature. This is some data from Santiago Gregera, and the point is that you do indeed see critical fluctuations exactly where you think the metamagnetic quantum critical endpoint should be. Then you would ask, well, how good then is this picture of itinerant ferromagnetism being described by the RG approach? In particular, can you assume an itinerant picture? The answer to that seems to be that we can, namely, very clean materials have been made such that one can track the quantum oscillation frequencies as you go up to, not quite through, but then beyond the metamagnetic critical endpoint. And you do indeed see that volume changes are essentially continuous as you approach that. The changes are relatively small and entirely consistent with the magnetic moment that you observe as you go through the critical point. Also, you can see the mass starting to diverge on various Fermi surface sheets, which is what you see from this property. Okay, so I don't really want to say very much about the theory, except that if you like, this is the textbook example of the Hertz approach to the ferromagnetic critical point, because many of these non-analyticities go away when you break the rotation, well, they all go away when you break the rotational symmetry with an applied magnetic field. And this really, if you like, is the quantum version of the liquid gas transition. But then when you ask, well, how well, you've got this textbook example, how well does it actually fit to the theory? The answer is that at least away from it, it's not too bad, but surely the whole point was to get very close to the critical point and show power laws behaving correctly over numbers of decades. This is the coefficient of the T squared resistivity being shown to diverge more or less with the power law you expect. Now, field is the tuning parameter. However, it's what is becoming more and more clear is that as you make cleaner and cleaner samples, something very different is happening at the quantum critical endpoint. This old data showed something strange happening in the temperature dependence of the resistivity, but with cleaner samples, we see that the biggest signature that you're getting is this big rise in the residual resistivity at exactly where you think the critical endpoint would be. And moreover, the temperature dependence of the resistivity from having some weak, perhaps T-linear dependence, is becoming essentially temperature independent at this quantum critical point with a minimum that seems to go out as you increase the sample purity. So what we're finding is that this quantum critical endpoint is incredibly sensitive to disorder. And in fact, the cleaner you make it, the more dramatic the changes seem to be. Now, of course, there's much work on the role of disorder at quantum critical points. I'll show you that in a second. Yeah. So this issue of what disorder does at the quantum critical point has been argued by a number of people, and I'm not going to say much more about that because it's going to be discussed this afternoon. But suffice it to say that what's happening in this material looks much more than corrections to the metallic behavior. Instead, so here now is the susceptibility, and in fact what you see is this peak in the resistivity is associated with some dissipation in the susceptibility. So this is the imaginary part of the susceptibility, which is used in this material as a signature of there being two first order transitions sandwiching this resistivity peak. Now, there's a reason why you might expect that, and that is that if you couple to other harmonic degrees of freedom, for example, lattice degrees of freedom, then that indeed can essentially do more or less what we were discussing at zero magnetic field of driving the interactions negative. The difference here now is you don't get a tricritical point because you're now expanding your theory about the original critical endpoint, so there's no symmetry reason for not having a phi cubed term in terms of the deviation from the magnetization. And so what can happen is you can stop this thing eventually going to the critical point. Instead, what can happen is two first order transitions appear, rather like the wings of at the tricritical point in zero field, only they're now no longer connected to each other. This doesn't get rid of the quantum critical point, but it just moves it around. And what seems to be happening here in this material is that you're losing it. Nevertheless, more than that still seems to be happening. Yeah?
So your analogy with the liquid gas transition, I shouldn't now go looking for surrounding
Right, well, it is known that fluctuations can drive many second-order phase transitions to go first-order. So I should say that this is not new physics that's appearing here. I guess O.K. Rice did something in the 50s, and Larkin and Pickin have done it. So it's well known that, at least for insulating materials, that critical points can be driven first-order by coupling to other harmonic degrees of freedom. So. That is a feature of this particular theory. So what's happened is one of them's moved off, and the other and a second minimum has been induced by the fluctuation effects.
Right, now, is it new experimental?
Oh, this is new data on this material.
Right, but
has it been seen elsewhere? I don't know, actually. Sorry, now I understand your question. Okay, well, I'm about to be stopped. So. I was going to show you some hints that there was some unusual phase here. There's just one more bit of physics that I should at least mention in an overview. Sorry about this, the quickest way of getting through it. That is to say, one of the motivations for studying quantum critical points has been the induction of new phases, particularly superconductivity. So since no one else is going to be talking about, I think, superconductivity near a ferromagnetic quantum critical point, let me just survey some of the things that are being debated at the moment. One is that the issue as to whether the transition goes to zero at where you would have thought the original ferromagnetic quantum critical point should be. And that is the notion that actually ferromagnetic fluctuations can ultimately be paired breaking. And so many people have been looking at phase diagrams like this. Recently, our chairman and collaborators have argued that the transition goes first order. And really, one is left, though, arguing, are any of the experimental examples of ferromagnetic superconductors in any of the categories that I've discussed, are they being driven by ferromagnetic critical fluctuations, or is something else driving them? And so, let me... you can ask about that. Okay, so I should get really to my main conclusions. That is to ask the open question, well, where is the ferromagnetic quantum critical point now? We've moved it into the field plane to get a magnetic one, but the experimental example that we have now shows physics that is potentially richer. Now, what is the connection then between these non-analytic terms, the various approaches to the non-analytic terms in the effective action? How should we really treat them? Do we know for certain that this transition is first order? Is there the possibility of a Q-dependent, ordering at finite Q? And finally, superconductivity may be induced by proximity to the original ferromagnetic critical point. Are other sorts of phases possible at these more exotic critical endpoints? Thank you.
On the issue of two intermingling positions with N is long scattering in between.
Yes.
Last week, John Myers showed us another example of that, if I remember correctly. Now, what was the material?
Yeah, uranium routine to silicon tube, which maybe if you would show us your Rabbitier phase diagram.
Thank you. Okay, so that's a plant question. Apparently it's not. Right, so let me show you. Okay, sorry. I'm stuck. No. Okay, so I don't know quite why it's not doing that. Let me.
Yeah, there is another question.
Okay.
More than
Since you brought up the molecule used in the superconductivity way, this is the non presence of surfacing material as a superconductor, meaning that this claim has been refuted or withdrawn, or are you not commenting on it for some other reason?
Okay, so, well, I probably shouldn't be the person to comment on this, but I left it out because I believe there is some doubt as to whether bulk superconductivity has really been seen in zirconium zinc 2. Since you have the author of that original paper here, I would defer to...
Okay.
No, I did what you told me. I left it out. Right, so I think it's not a...
Let's go to the next question.
No, I think it's an important question.
Yeah.
Right. That was my brief. No. So of course there's a wealth of work on antiferromagnetic incommensurate spin density wave transitions, and Hertz covered that as well. The physics that I was talking about associated with the transition eventually going first order is specific to the ferromagnetic version, if that answers your question. Yeah.
What would happen if you looked up the data with these two transitions, not as a function of field, but as a function of magnetization?
I don't know the answer to that. Yep.
Could it be possible they would just collapse?
No, they both correspond to both jumps in the magnetization. So it's not so you're not going to put them on top of each other. They really correspond to different. If you track the magnetization through them, there's a first order jump and a second first order jump. And at both cases the magnetization rises. So it's not that you have a sort of bubble of high magnetization dropping down. And in fact, that was one of the challenging things to make a theory that would do that. To see if I did.
How well is the case in metamagnetism coming from single
energy? Okay. So, right. Well, I guess I would have to say that these systems are rather far from single ion materials. An itinerant pitcher, as I believe you're going to hear in Christoph Bergmann's talk, an itinerant pitcher for these ruthenates seems to work incredibly well. So I don't see any reason to abandon an itinerant pitcher for these particular materials. Particularly, the way the de Haussmann-Alphen captures, the quantum oscillations captures the Fermi surface evolution and relates it to magnetization.
Yes.
You can actually in some of these, at least in some of these ruthenates, you can. And again, you're going to hear about that, I believe, a little bit later. So, hold that question.
You mentioned that this was the ideal case of the quantum analog of the liquid gas transition. and that things look rather good if you don't come in too close to the quantum critical point. So my question to you is, you showed the very beautiful color plot of resistivity from the Science article, which seems to show something very close to a linear in T resistivity. Could you give us a status update on whether that eminently simple property is well understood or not via this eminently simple quantum critical point theory?
Okay, so the answer to your question is that in 2D, the interaction terms, although irrelevant, do play an important role, which tells you that the coefficient, the four-thirds that you would naively expect at a ferromagnetic quantum critical point, or indeed this metamagnetic transition from the Gaussian theory, is strongly corrected. Now, we calculated that in the original paper. The power law goes down. It does look actually fairly stable numerically, and at about 1.2. Now, how does that compare with the experiment? The answer is that what you want is decades of temperature to really track these power laws down. Yes, it more or less looks linear, but as I showed you, there's a minimum in the resistivity, and of course, this theory just does not have that in any sense.
But apart from that, it seems to more or less
fit. More or less fit, but not so convincingly that I would plot it up and say this is it. I mean, really, the test of this theory to power laws is best done along the zero temperature axis and scan with field, because then you really are in have the Gaussian theory to compare with, which is why I showed you the A coefficient apparently diverging with a power law. That's the thing that you would really have used to test those power laws. Something else seems to be happening near the critical point, which means that precisely where you would really want to get close to the critical point, check the robustness of the power laws, you don't see anything.
The A coefficient really probes whether you understand the renormalization to the Fermi liquid that form at absolute zero. It doesn't really test whether you've understood
the nature of the critical point. That's a good point. Yep, that's a fair point.
My understanding is that power force is changed in two dimensions.
Right.
Yeah.
But not asymptotically.
No, not asymptotically. But in a real experiment, you would.
But the simplicity is still
good. Of course, yes. I mean, flows to zero eventually. But if you really were trying to compare with experiment, you would have to worry about that. Yes, I'm assuming that it's two dimensions. And the reason for doing that partly came from that fit to the divergence of the A coefficient, which fitted the two-thirds better than the one-third divergence, minus one-third divergence, which 3D was expecting. Simply that it's a very anisotropic, it's a layered material, so it's very anisotropic, a factor of about 500 in the resistivity between A and B plane and C axis.
Last question.
What
are possible, you mentioned these possible phases except for superconductivity. What are possibilities at the level of scenarios?
Okay, well, there are a number of things that you want to explain. So you want to explain the strong disorder dependence, or rather, the extreme sensitivity disorder. That suggests that something in momentum space is playing an important role. Also, you want something that will give this massive increase in the residual resistivity, as you see that go through this point. So the picture that we came up with was basically one of a distortion of the Fermi surface shape, which breaks a rotational symmetry. Take a circular Fermi surface, imagine it elongating along one of the two crystalline directions. It's sensitive to momentum, it's a shape change in momentum space, so if you washed out momentum information, then you might have this transition to go away. There are two possible orientations. The system may break up into domains, and that would be what you would be seeing in the large increase in the residual resistivity. And it would also explain why cycling the system through these transitions tends to make it very brittle. Of course, we know that there's strong coupling to the lattice anyway.
So exactly, yes. It's kind of ordering in space.
In momentum space. So it's not spatially ordering, but the conjecture is that it's ordering in the momentum space.
Okay,
that's a conjecture.
Two questions. Do you know any ferromagnetic transition with the transition temperature going down continuously, which at low enough transition temperature is not first order?
Are you going to tell us one? So, the next talk. What I don't know is if in a clean, in a very clean system, but I really don't know what you're going to tell us about. Sorry. A dangerous thing to say.
When the transition temperature is low enough,
yeah.
When it's coming on the scale of a degree already, the dipolar interactions are just as important as anything else that one might be considering, mm-hmm. And they have...
Right, so a long
and
long range, yeah. No, that's an interesting point.
And has anybody seriously thought about what
Not that I know of.
In particular, I would even expect the nature of the transition to become shape dependent in the sample.
So the question was, effects like dipolar interactions, are they likely to play a role at those extremely low energy scales? In particular, that could give not only a long-range nature to the interaction, but also an angle dependence to the interaction as well. And the answer is, I don't know that anybody's done it. I mean, there is this issue of how big the effect is if the moment is small, but...
Dipolar interaction.
Yep.
Okay. Thanks very much.
Okay.